From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Okay, here we go. 4th of July weekend, hallelujah, it is summer. If you're a reader with a little luck, that means time to do it, to read. But what? We've got suggestions today from literary fiction to serious social commentary to charming biographies and page-turning thrillers. This hour On Point, the books of summer 2016. You can join us on air or online where this conversation is always on. What are you looking for this summer in a great read? What have you found? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. We've got a great crew with us today to look at what's out there, what might suit you. Joining us now from San Francisco, Kristen Evans, owner of the Booksmith Independent Bookstore in San Francisco. Kristen Evans, welcome to On Point. Wonderful to have you here.
Thank you for having me.
From Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, Tony Norman joins us, columnist and editor of the Book Review at the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette. Tony, welcome back.
Hey, Tom. Good to be here.
And from New York, Jamie Green is here, literary critic. Her pieces have appeared in Longreads, The All, The Millions, and more. She's also managing editor at Google Play Books, although she is not officially representing Google with us today, we're obliged to say. Jamie Green, thanks for joining us.
Hi, Tom. Thanks so much for having me.
I just want to dive right into these books. Tony, you've got The Girls on your list, and it's getting a lot of attention because it's kind of echo of the Manson family story from years back. What's the story?
The story is about a young 14-year-old girl named Evie who becomes sort of enamored of a, as you said, a cult-like family of girls. And it's told from the perspective of her as a middle-aged woman and how she went about extracting herself from real danger.
Does it look like a straight kind of reinterpretation of the Mansons, Charles Manson's story, or is it just inspired
Actually,
in a way?
It's inspired by. It's really about the coming of age of a young girl to woman, and it's really about relationships between women. So it's the Manson family or the Manson-like family is really just sort of the thriller elements on the fringes. It's really about relationships between women.
The Girls by Emma Klein. I think you've got a little reading from that. Could you give us just a taste and maybe set it up for us? What's going on here, Tony?
Absolutely. This is actually page one because it really sucks you in from here. So I looked up because of the laughter and kept looking because of the girls. I noticed their hair first, long and uncombed, then their jewelry catching the sun. The three of them were far enough away that I saw only the periphery of their features, but it didn't matter. I knew they were different from everyone else in the park, families milling in a vague line, waiting for sausages and burgers from the open grill, women in checked blouses scooting into their boyfriend's sides, kids tossing eucalyptus buttons at the feral-looking chickens that overran the strip. These long-haired girls seemed to glide above all that was happening around them, tragic and separate, like royalty in exile. And this is really the opening paragraph to this very perceptive woman's look back at what attracted her to this family in the first place, this trio of girls and then their larger family. And it's just terrific.
It's nice writing. Is it a gruesome book ultimately? Does it have that?
It is not a gruesome book. Mm-hmm. It's but I mean, there are certainly elements of fear and death and danger and all that. But gruesome is not quite the word I would use to describe it.
Cult
at all.
Life. Jamie Green, in New York, just having the word girls in the title seems to be kind of a trend this summer, if I'm not mistaken. What's at the top of your list for 2016 summer, Jamie?
One of my favorites is a book that doesn't have girls in the cover, okay, in the title, but is about a very close friendship between two girls. It's Rich and Pretty by Ruman Alam. And the, we should call them women.
Mm-hmm.
I suppose, are
yes,
a little older. They're in their late 20s or early 30s, and it follows two friends, Sarah and Lauren, who've been friends since they were 11, over a big chunk of their young adulthood now, seeing how they struggle or decide not to or try to stay together as their lives start to diverge.
I don't know, Ruman Alam, is that a man? Is that a woman?
It is. It's a man. It's his first novel. And it's really remarkable. I'm not usually the sort of person who, anytime a man writes a female character who isn't a cardboard cutout, to go, oh my God, a man wrote
Amazing.
A woman.
How do you do that?
Right. But in this case, the book is so insightful, not just into the women as people, but the women as women, that I was reading it on my phone and I kept taking screenshots and texting it to my friends being like, how did he know this? There's this sort of running joke among us that he's a witch, but he's actually just an incredibly insightful, empathetic writer.
Rich and Pretty by Ruman Alamin. What happens with this friendship over the course of the book? Is it a story of falling in and out of friendship, of drifting or coming closer or transformation?
I think it's really all of the above. It's one of those really lovely novels where there's no dramatic event, almost in the complete opposite of The Girls, which builds and builds and builds to this one climactic night. Rich and Pretty follows Sarah and Lauren over, I don't know, maybe 7 or 8 years of their friendship, and just tracks the way that they are so entangled in each other's lives, but also at times drift, come back together, transform. It's just a really familiar, wonderful, really insightful, lovely novel.
Sarah, the daughter of a retired singer and former advisor to the president. You know that combo, retired singers that advise
right.
presidents. And Lauren, an associate editor for a publisher of cookbooks. That sounds very New York. Kristen, take us to your view from San Francisco. First out of the gate, we've got a nice list from you here. But what would you speak to first for a good read, summer 2016?
Well, at the top of my list is a local author named Naaman Tullahan. It's an urban fantasy called The Root. And, you know, I love discovering new writers, and I'd compare this one to On London by China Miéville. Mm-hmm. Naaman is active in the local Bay Area scene, also LGBT and sci-fi fantasy literary scenes. And it has a fantastical San Francisco as a main stage called Zabub. And
I mean, reading here a line that says, a gay former child star discovers he's descended from gods and destined to fight supernatural creatures. Okay, we're out there.
It's out there. It's a book that is a fast-paced read. There's a lot of action, but there's just some, you know, the thing about having a book that is written with someone with a completely different perspective is you encounter characters that you don't normally see on the page. And I think that this is a really unique voice that we now have in our local scene here.
The Root by Naaman Tullahan. Give us another while we're with you in San Francisco there, Kristen. What have you got on your list? What else?
Yeah, well, you know, very timely in the news. We've had a lot of discussion about the Stanford rape case. And there's a terrific memoir by music rock critic Sarah Heppala called Blackout, just released in paperback this month. And, you know, she talks about becoming an alcoholic at a very young age, like before she was a teenager, practically. And she talks about her experience of relying on alcohol to get through awkward social situations. And she does it with such humor and grace. I mean, I think these kind of recovery stories, sometimes we've seen a lot of them, but this one is just really special. She also, you know, talks about blacking out, which is different than passing out. Passing out is where you're like, you know, out on the floor, but blackout is when you are no longer able to form long-term memories, and you do have the capacity to have short-term memory, so that's like 2 minutes long. So you can hold on a conversation, you can be up walking and talking, but you're not actually going to remember an hour later what happened.
There's been several of these sort of drinking memoirs over the years. I mean Caroline Knapp had one. Who else? I mean, this is a field that people have worked in before. Is Sarah Heppala's Blackout different from what you've read in the I Drank Myself to the Brink and Beyond genre?
Yeah, you know, I think Sarah brings a fresh perspective as a, you know, somewhat affluent, educated woman in our modern day society. And so I think, you know, we definitely have seen some great books like The Big Fix, which is about overcoming heroin. There's a lot of addiction and recovery memoirs. I would say I probably see two or three good ones every season. But Sarah's really stands out as a funny take on, you know, the incidents that she gets herself into. She's very relatable, and it has a happy ending. So,
Blackout by Sarah Heppele. Tony Norman, feed us more and more from Pittsburgh. We're stacking our shelves for the summer here. What else have you got?
Oh, okay. A book that I think should hopefully be at the top of everyone's list is a book called Underground Airlines by Ben H. Winters. It comes out in a week or two, and the premise is really quite interesting. Imagine a contemporary America with one major exception. The Civil War never happened, and slavery still exists in four states.
Whoa.
And this book is a wonderful sort of look at this sort of alternative universe. You know, how are social relations between black people and white people in the free states?
Mm-hmm.
And what sort of tensions exist when you see black people in the free states, but there might be some suspicion that they are runaways
from the South? Is it set in the contemporary, like right now, Tony, with slaves walking around?
With people have iPhones and you know, all the advanced tech that we currently have, and black people are social equals in most of the states. In 46 of the 50 states, but they have to have their papers. You know, you have to be able to prove that you are not you know, a runaway. And so it's a fabulous. It's a really interesting book, and I can't put it down.
Underground Airlines, just about to hit the shelves by Ben Winters. Alternate history thriller. Here's one description, says Ralph Ellison's The Invisible Man meets Blade Runner. With the Civil War never happened, and there's still slavery in four states. It's on Tony Norman's list. He joins us from the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette. Jamie Green is here, managing editor of Google Play Books. Kristen Evans is with us from the Booksmith independent bookstore in San Francisco. We're talking about great reads for the summer of 2016. What are you looking for in a great read this summer? What do you want? What do you need? What have you found? I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking about great summer reads for 2016. Books to keep you company, keep you engaged, enthralled on the beach, by the lake, on the porch swing, in the shade. Jamie Green is with us, managing editor of Google Play Books, with us from New York today. Kristen Evans from the Booksmith independent bookstore in San Francisco. Tony Norman is here, columnist, book review editor at the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette. And we'd really like to hear from you as well. What are you looking for in a great book this summer? Do you want to dream, travel, shudder, explore, escape? Are you looking to learn with some hard-nosed nonfiction? Are you looking to get lifted in great literature, get lost in something a little more down and dirty? You tell us. We just heard about Blackout on The Drinking Life by Sarah Heppele from Kristen. Kristen, you've got a little reading from that. If you could give us just a taste. This is from the prelude. It's called The City of Light here in Blackout. Would you read just a little?
Of course. I'm in Paris on a magazine assignment, which is exactly as great as it sounds. I eat dinner at a restaurant so fancy, I have to keep resisting the urge to drop my fork just to see how fast someone will pick it up. I'm drinking cognac, the booze of kings and rap stars, and I love how the snifter sinks between the crooks of my fingers, amber liquid sloshing up the sides as I move it in a figure eight, like swirling the ocean in the palm of my hand. Somewhere near midnight, I tumble into a cab with my friend, and the night starts to stutter and skip. She leans into me, the bundle of scarf around her face. It's cold. We are squished together on the vinyl seat, too lit to care about the intimacy of our limbs. The streets are a smear through the window, the taxi meter a red blur. How did we get back so fast? A second ago, we were laughing in the cab, and now I'm standing on the street, alone.
From Blackout by Sarah Heppele, and they get lit a lot. Anthony's calling from Riverdale, Georgia. Anthony, you're on the air. Thanks for calling. What do you like? What are you looking for?
Hello. I came across a book called I Like God, written by Jeff Yeager and Sky Bynes.
Okay.
And it's about a young man who created a face page for God. And
a Facebook page? Are you saying a Facebook page for God?
Yes.
That's cheeky.
And after about 3 years, he had forgotten all about it, and he goes back, and he has over 37 million lives. He's an unemployed delivery driver living in the basement of his mother's home, mom and dad's home. He's a mixed-race kid, and he has no future, but he finagles away with this book. It's a pretty good story. It's called I Like God by Jeff Yeager and Scott Byers.
Anthony, tell us, what emerges on that Facebook page for God? Where does the story go? Is it about, I don't know, escape, redemption, or love? What?
Well, it's all of that. What happens is the guy starts reading some of the people start posting to this page as if they're talking to God. Mm-hmm. And with him being a young man, he doesn't take it seriously until one day he asks them to do something to see what the influence will be. And he influences them not like some of our evangelists do today, for financial reasons. And the story evolves. It's a pretty good story. I recommend the book.
You've got our attention right out there, Anthony. I Like God by Jeff Yeager and Sky Bynes. Okay, a Facebook page for God. Jimmy Green, give us another. What else have you got up high?
Another one that I really love is Some Possible Solutions, which is a book of short stories by Helen Phillips. I know some people like summer reading to be like big, heavy books. You know, you camp out at the beach and that's the time to read the book that's too heavy to carry around every day. But I like summer reading that is light and engaging and in small bites. And so I think some of the stories in this book are only 2 pages long. They're all light and beautiful, but also there's this weird sort of surreal thing going on in many of the stories. They're either set in a near future or a slightly alternate version of our world, just sort of looking at what if something was a little different in one way or another. And it's completely captivating.
It's called Some Possible Solutions by Helen Phillips, short stories. I think you've got a reading from that with some really lovely language in it. Is there a name for this short story you're reading from?
This one's called The Joined, and it's probably as close to science fiction as anything in this collection gets.
And what's the gist of the story before you read? What's going on here?
I'm going to be reading the very beginning of it, which I think will set it up well.
Great.
Part of what's so delightful and enjoyable about this book is the way that the stories surprise you with what ends up happening in them, so I don't want to give too much away.
Okay, fair. We want to listen.
The pretty astronaut strolls in a landscape reminiscent of Earth, except the dirt is purple, the sky yellow, and the grass red. Aside from these details, we are reminded of the medieval hamlets we once learned about in our textbooks. She winds through a meadow, approaching a cluster of thatched cottages. Her movements are stiffened by the space suit, but still we can tell she is graceful. When she reaches the village, she finds a small crowd of aliens gathered in the central square. These aliens are much more like humans than anyone would have expected. Their skin comes in various shades of tan and brown. They wear dresses and pants. There are old ones, babies, children, couples, as on Earth. In fact, they resemble humans almost exactly, except that, well, how to say it, there's something vaguer around the edges, a bit blurry. It's hard to feel entirely confident about where their bodies end.
I have to say, I just fell in love with that reading from Some Possible Solutions. I'm ready to go with that. Does it hold up throughout? It's a collection of short stories.
Absolutely. Each story is its own strange, vivid world. Some are very much set in our world. Some seem to be closer to the author's own life. There's one where the main character is Helen. Some are as strange and surreal as what I just read, but every single one is exquisite. And what's really amazing about it to me is, so there's this sort of surreal, weird, not quite our world, speculative thing going on throughout most of the stories. And often books that go that way can end up feeling a little cold. And instead, this book is warm and generous and very concerned with human relationships. There are a lot of stories that show something about marriages or relationships, a lot about parents and children's, mothers and babies. It's an incredibly humane book.
Fantastic sound to it. Some Possible Solutions by Helen Phillips. Let me turn in another direction. Brace yourself, Tony. This is from a book that gets referenced on your list called Florence Foster Jenkins, the biography about a rich New Yorker with a vanity singing career. She was called the worst singer in the world. We'll hear about the book. Here's an example of her singing. Okay, Tony, redeem us here. Lawrence, Foster, Jenkins, all exclamation marks, The Life of the World's Worst Opera Singer by Daryl Bullock. How does he turn that singing into a book that we want to read?
First of all, you will want to read it because the writing in this book is exquisite. It's very funny. It's really a book about the lack of self-awareness among those who are from the better classes, as it were. And Florence Foster Jenkins was a woman of privilege who was able to finance her singing career at the center of New York's cultural world in the 1930s and 40s. And yeah. In fact, at the age of, I think she was 75 or 76, in 1944, she was able to sing at Carnegie Hall to a packed audience. And presumably, not all those people were paid to be there. And she was just the toast of the cultural world. But it isn't really clear that she understood that she was a figure of kitsch and that people were laughing at her and not necessarily with her. She just really believed that she was a super talented person, and no one would tell her otherwise. And it's just a fascinating, exquisitely written book, and one that will make you a fan, if not of her singing, then of her times, and you know, when American really could redefine themselves and make themselves into whatever they wanted to be. It's quite a beauty.
Incredible. Florence Foster Jenkins, all exclamation marks there. And I mean, people will pay attention as well, because I think there's a big Hollywood film coming out, Hugh Grant, Meryl Streep, later this year, about
Streep
her life.
The title character, yes. And, you know, I'm going to be the first person in line. And I think that this really is an amazing, I mean, when it comes to self awareness, I mean, who among us doesn't realize that?
Use a little work?
needs a lot of work, and she certainly did.
Was singing like that, you'd like to think you could hear it, but maybe you can't. Dina in Columbia, South Carolina. Dina, you're on the air. Thank you for calling.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I like to read books that focus on Southern literary genre, that really see beauty developing from tragedy. And we lost two great Southern fiction writers this year, Pat Conroy and Harper Lee.
Yes.
And I just really encourage people to go back and read their books and you know, just really delve into the quirkiness, but the haunting beauty of, you know, Southern literature. I'm an author myself, and I really hope that I've honored their memory in some ways by carrying that on, and other authors, local authors, would continue to do that. You know, we're really always in the South. We're kind of always in post-Civil War South.
Yeah.
Even in our culture, our modern culture, and there's the idiosyncrasies and the dynamics of the racial divide, and it's really wonderful when you read something that shows the beauty of that and the redemption of that, and I really encourage people to read those stories.
I'm right there with you, Dina, especially in the summer when that swelter can come right into your bones. And Pat Conroy, some of the best conversation we've had here was with him when he was robust and around. How about the one that Tony mentioned there, Underground Airlines by Ben Winters? You're a writer. You're in the South. Can you picture a contemporary America with slavery still in effect in four Southern states? Maybe yours, Dina? Can you imagine that as a premise for a book?
Oh, yes. I mean, there's just so many the dynamics, and we saw that, you know, with the shooting at Emanuel and the coming down of the Confederate flag. I mean, there's just, it's almost like you're still trapped in that time warp, you know. But it's, you know, we do have beautiful relationships between the races here. And when you read something about that, and I think you do in with Harper Lee and Pat Conroy, and hopefully in the stories that I've written, when you see that, I mean, it's just, you know, it brings attention to it in a positive way.
Dina, we've got it. What's your full name, Dina?
Dina Balknight.
Dina Balknight. Dina, we appreciate your call very much. Kristen, keep us moving here from San Francisco. What else have you got to recommend?
Mm-hmm. Should we switch to some nonfiction?
Sure.
So, you know, I sort of went through this phase where I was reading a lot of dystopia, like Margaret Atwood and Olivia Butler, Octavia Butler, and there's a great one about the post-drought world called Gold Fame Citrus by Claire V. Watkins. But I then did like a full switch to like real life dystopia and, you know, read The New Jim Crow. Of course, the Thomas Piketty Capital has been really powerful to understand income inequality. And I remember as a young woman reading Barbara Ehrenreich's Nickel and Diamond, really understanding what it's like to be working poor. So I put this book up there as an indispensable read to better understand our American society today.
Give us the name again.
It's called Evicted by Matthew Desmond. And he's a Harvard Harvard professor, but he spent a year and a half living amongst Milwaukee's poor, and he talked about, you know, basically how our housing stock has changed to be a kind of a professional business, and there's a really true exploitation of low-income folks where they're spending, you know, way too much of their income on housing that's really substandard and insecure. And it really helps to better understand, you know, why we have a housing crisis, particularly here in the Bay Area, but also, you know, the types of discrimination that are actually legalized, that are legal, that occur, that really disrupt somebody's ability to kind of steady themselves. So, you know, a lot of single moms are kind of constantly kicked out of their homes. And you know, having children is not, you know, one of those things that you can say that it's a protected category of person.
Not at all. I've dipped into that Evicted by Matthew Desmond, and it is powerful on the nonfiction front. We're looking at great reads for the summer of 2016. Jamie, take us on. Take us on.
I've got, on the nonfiction end, two books that tone-wise are totally different from Evicted, but that I think fit together really nicely. The first is Grunt by Mary Roach. It's the latest from the extraordinary, funny science writer Mary Roach. She's written Gulp, Bonk, Spook, Stiff, and here she tackles the science of war, which does not necessarily seem like the right area for America's goofiest science writer, but it actually works perfectly. She's very respectful and curious and brings readers into this whole world, not of fighting war, but of all of the research that goes on in order to make war, paradoxically, safer and more effective and to take care of the people who are injured in it. And so rather than looking at the huge, weighty, serious topics that other journalists are tackling, she digs into the nooks and crannies of, you know, shark repellent and stink bombs and maggots and all sorts of really fascinating, really, really funny stuff. And she balances the tone pretty exceptionally.
A book on war that makes it something you want to get exhaustion, shock, bacteria, panic. Do we come out just holding our head in our hands or somehow not?
No, not at all. I mean, there is emotional impact. She doesn't ignore the fact that people are being injured and losing their lives. But it's much more about the scientific research. And so the characters here are the scientists and the administrators. And she manages to find the corners that are worthy of being poked fun at, and she pokes fun at herself. And I mean, when you're talking about maggots and stink bombs, it would be awful not to laugh.
Grunt by Mary Roach for some insight into the many, many facets of war. James Brown behind us right here. Of course, James McBride has written about him this year in Kill 'Em and Leave. We talked with him. We'll talk about that book. Kristen Evans is with us from the Booksmith in San Francisco. Jamie Green from Google Play Books. Tony Norman from the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette. We're looking at great summer reads 2016. What are you looking for this summer? What have you found? I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back.
Wow, I feel good. I knew that I would not. I feel good. I knew that I would. So good. So good. But I got you.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point, and we're talking about great summer reads for 2016, books to keep you company wherever you are this summer with time on your hands and a hankering for something really good. Between those covers, Tony Norman is with us from the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette, Jamie Green from Google Play Books, Kristen Evans from the Booksmith Bookstore in San Francisco. You can join us as well. What are you looking for this summer in your book bag? Have your tastes changed over the summers? From what and to what, maybe? What's this summer's Gone Girl or Fates and Furies? And where will you do your best, most treasured reading this summer? Paint us a picture of that place. Will reading this year be your refuge from politics and woe or something else? Lots of readers writing in. John heard that little bit of tape of Florence Foster Jenkins and says, I hope the Florence Foster Jenkins book is not available as an audiobook. Okay, that's funny. Vaquera is right there with your suggestion on Blackout, Kristen. Says there's a lot in there about self-esteem, rape, consent, therapy session with humor and deep insight. Here's one. Hello Kitty says, I just read Little Children by Tom Perata. Blew through that book. It was so good. And a question for all of you. Lisa says, I'm looking for historical novels. I've read all the, I guess, Bill O'Reilly, Killing Abraham Lincoln and all those. And Eric Larson. I know a lot of Eric Larson fans out there. Any similar suggestions on the historical novel front? Tony, Kristen, Jamie?
Nothing occurs to me in terms of historical
new
novels.
Okay.
Yeah.
I have Mothering Sunday on my list.
Oh, good. Tell us. Mothering Sunday. Kristen.
Yeah, it's I would say it's for Downton Abbey fans. It's definitely got the upstairs-downstairs collision. Mm-hmm. It's a 22-year-old woman named Jane Fairchild who's worked at a maid at an English country house since she was 16. And for almost all of those years, she's been in a love affair with the neighbor, Paul Sheringham, young heir of the neighboring house. And the two meet on a unseasonably warm March day. And it's a fast-paced read. It's also written really with spare prose. And it's a steamy romance.
A tryst, the word comes up here right away, and maybe relevant on this day when we're thinking about the 100th anniversary of the Battle of the Somme. And this one is set, in the early 20s when England's still kind of trying to recover from the loss of all those young men, all that loss and grief.
Mm-hmm. The war does play a backdrop role in this particular book.
Hans is calling from Nashville, Tennessee. Hans, you're on the air.
Thank you, Tom. Can you hear me okay, sir?
Yes, we can. What have you got?
Yes, sir. If anybody's interested in a literary roller coaster, I highly recommend Mr. Terry Goodkind and the Sword of Truth series that I've been reading since 1995, which begins with The Wizard's First Rule. I just finished the conclusion of that series called Warheart. Absolutely stunning series of books there, sir.
And what's it like? Is it like Dune or some of those? It's fantasy?
No. It's fantasy, but it goes through the evolution of the main character, Richard Cypher, through through virtue of his birthright, becomes Richard Rawl, and basically Terry Goodkind takes the reader through his evolution through a series of 17 books. Starting back in 1995 and up to present day. Currently, I'm reading The First Confessor, The Legend of Magda Sirius. I'm really hoping they make that into a movie. They actually made the Legend of the Seeker a TV series. I'm really sad that...
Hans, we got it. You're way into the world of Terry Goodkind and the Sword of Truth. 17 books in and no... Sounds like no flagging of enthusiasm right there. We appreciate your sharing that. McDonough, Georgia. Annette, you're on with us, Annette. Thank you for calling.
Hi. I am anxious to share with your listening audience
Yes.
this fabulous book called Trampling of the Weeds.
Hmm.
It's a fictional account of a family, a dysfunctional family. There's three teenagers that have to be self-supportive because their mother, who's independent, who's chemically dependent, is just bedridden for the most part.
Okay.
And what's great about this author, you start the book pulling for one of the two of the characters and despising another. And then as the story develops, you end up pulling for the other. And what's exceptional is that the author makes you realize that, unbeknownst to me, that we practice classism oftentimes. We judge not knowing, what's behind people's actions. But the oldest child is charged with trying to, provide for the family by the only means that she's able to do because of her age and so forth. But it's a wonderful,
Trampling of the Weeds. And what's the author's name, Annette?
Trampling of the Weeds by Lawanda Lalise G.
Lawanda Lalise G. I appreciate that recommendation as well. Thank you, Annette. One more. Marianne in Fort Collins, Colorado. Marianne, you're on.
Hi.
Hi.
I'm looking for a good read that I can't put down this summer. But I don't like scary books.
Okay, what do you like? So our panel of wizards can figure it out for you here.
Well, two books that I've recently read were All the Light You Cannot See.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And then another one that I just read was The Jesus Cow.
Don't know it, The Jesus Cow. But just absolutely gripping, but not scary. For Marianne in Colorado, Kristen, have you got a suggestion off your store shelves?
Well, The Mothering Sunday is definitely a good parallel to All the Light You Cannot See.
By Graham Swift, okay.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Jamie, Tony, any others that might fall into Marianne's mind and just not let go?
I think Before the Fall by Noah Hawley, who is the showrunner for Fargo, would be a good one. It's about a plane goes down near Martha's Village, and there are two survivors, a painter and a little boy. And then the novel takes us back and forth in time to figure out, you know, how they got there and possibly why the plane went down and who might be responsible. The child is a child of extreme wealth, and the artist is a vagabond, yet they're the only survivors of this private plane that goes down. I think she would be very, very gripped by this this book.
Before the Fall. Who's the author
by
again?
Noah Hawley, Hawley.
I should say that my guests' full summer reading lists will all be available at our website, are now at onpointradio.org. There's a suggestion for you, Marianne in Fort Collins, Colorado. Jamie, you've got some more nonfiction that we didn't get to at the break there. What have you got?
Yeah, the one that I feel like goes along with Mary Roach, because Mary Roach has written several books.
This is
many
Grunt
people probably,
by Mary Roach, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. There's a debut author named Elizabeth Greenwood, whose first book comes out in August, and it's called Playing Dead. It's nonfiction. Hmm. And this is about people who have tried to fake their own deaths.
For real? This is nonfiction,
yeah.
Okay?
This is nonfiction. And it's the premise that it starts out with is that Elizabeth Greenwood has finished graduate school. She has, as tends to happen with that, $100,000 in student loan debt. And the idea gets in her head to fake her own death. And as happens when you are a nonfiction writer, she starts researching it and starts talking to people. And so the book, she talks to people who have faked their own deaths and failed, obviously, because she's talking to them. So we know they're alive. People who hunt down people who are faking their own deaths.
That's fascinating.
People who help people.
Yeah.
And what's really wonderful about it is it's very deeply researched, full of information. It's fascinating. It's such a strange, bizarre world. But she tells it with this sort of lightness and humor. She's in there herself as the reporter on this quest. And she's incredibly charming. And just with her talking to all these strange people who have, for whatever reason, tried to fake their own deaths, it's a surprisingly light and enjoyable read with the intense, strange subject matter.
Jamie, do most of them pull it off? Do they manage to successfully fake their own death to escape their student loans or whatever it is that they're getting away from?
Well, one of the things she discovers is that $100,000 in student loan debts is actually peanuts compared to the awful situations that people get themselves in, usually financially, but sometimes romantically, leading themselves to this extreme desperation that it takes in order to fake your own death. But one of the things she discovers is it's not only a lot harder than she thought it would be,
yeah,
it ends up being a lot harder than most people who try it thought that it would be.
Yeah. Well, that sounds pretty great. Give us the name again.
Playing Dead by Elizabeth Greenwood.
Got it. We got more nonfiction. One on your list, Tony, keeps the music theme going here. We heard a little James Brown coming out of the last section. James McBride was with us. His book, biography of James Brown, Kill 'Em and Leave, Searching for James Brown and the American Soul. We talked with him just a couple of months ago. Here was James McBride talking about James Brown and how he came at him in Kill 'Em and Leave.
My argument and my, you know, my thesis in this book is that he really was dancing through history. He came from a deep historical place because South Carolina has a special place in American history. And not all of it is, you know, necessarily good, but it is special.
Tony, we talked with James McBride. Talk to us about Kill 'Em and Leave. What brought it onto your list for the summer?
Well, I was just wandering around the bookstore. Normally, all sorts of books come to me for free, mm-hmm. you know, at the newspaper. But sure. This book somehow never came in a transom. I picked it up. And for me, the sign of a great book is if you start reading in a bookstore and you don't want to move. And so I was two chapters
yes,
in
I've been there.
Before I take it. And so, you know, it's about James Brown. And this, you know, he was probably the most important African-American artist, musician of the last, you know, 50, maybe 60 years. Mm-hmm. Yet when he – it took 8 months to bury him. And there was such fighting over his will to this day by his natural children and by his illegitimate children for this vast estate that by some estimates has been reduced from 300 million, 400 million to zero because of all the lawyers and all the fighting. And so James McBride does an incredible job just sort of charting the trajectory of James Brown's life. And the successes and the failures, and you know, he ended up in jail, and yep. and all of these things, and it's not a straight chronology. It is an impressionistic portrait of James Brown, but it's probably one of the best things I've read this year. It just really stuck with me, and it's so poignant, and because it's about race. And it's about wealth, and it's about expectation, and the burden of representation, and all of these things that go into, and it read like fiction, even though as far as I can tell, all of it is true.
Amazing music, amazing life, and pretty darn good book, Kill 'Em and Leave by James McBride about James Brown. We're looking at books, great reads for the summer of 2016. I noticed, Tony, that you and you, Kristen, both have what, Tony, you've got White Trash. Kristen, you've got White Rage by Carol Anderson. On your, what's mm-hmm. White Rage? This is nonfiction, Kristen. What's there?
Yeah, so this is the author is a professor and chair of the African-American Studies Department at Emory University. And she helps to reframe the way that we see the racial divide. She's written extensively about race relations and, you know, it's a perfectly timed book for understanding the current election season that we're in right now.
Does she bring up in particular an African-American perspective to this or simply an historian's work here?
But I would say both. Mm-hmm. You know, it follows off of the success of another book, The New Jim Crow. But, you know, talking about these trends of, you know, the war on drugs, Jim Crow laws, all of the things that have happened through history that essentially are a reaction to social progress of African Americans in our society.
And Tony, on your list is White Trash, the 400-year untold story of class in America by Nancy Eisenberg. What's there, Tony?
This is just, you know, to sort of pick up on the previous comments, I mean, this is a prism by which you can really look at this election year because the kind of folks who support Donald Trump are the sort of folks that Nancy Eisenberg writes about in this book. You know, the white folks who feel alienated and disenfranchised. And it's sort of a historical overview. You know, of it's not a whiteness studies book. It isn't anything narrowly academic like that. I think it's a full-throated historical look at America's conceit that it is like a classless society. You know, America has always been sort of ripped by classes. I mean, there are classes here. There is class consciousness here. And I think Nancy Eisenberg really, you know, wakes us up from our historical amnesia and shows us that, you know, America was originally a colonial dumping ground for the worst, you know, of you know, British society and European society. And
You're talking about my people now, Tony. Be careful there.
I tell you, Tom, I mean, you start reading this book, you know, a couple pages in, it's just like Kill 'Em and Leave. You're just going to be reading chunks and chunks of it, and you're not going to get any sleep. And it's very empathetic. It is not a, you know, look at those whites, you know, those rednecks.
Yeah,
you know, it is a deeply empathetic look at a class of people who are often forgotten.
Jamie, we've just got a minute left here. Give us another one or two. What else have you got that you can give us real quickly?
Keeping in line with sort of the human impacts of social issues, Shrill by Lindy West is a memoir by the Jezebel writer. It's got really great stuff about all sorts of social issues impacting women's lives, but it's also hilarious. And she moves between, you know, talking about those issues and the humor brilliantly.
Shrill by Lindy West and?
And Little Labors by Rivka Galchin. It's a very small literary book, nonfiction, a sort of collage of reflections on Galchin's pregnancy and first year or two of motherhood. Again, melding the literary with humor really brilliantly.
Little Labors by Rivka Galchin. We've got full lists, fuller than you've heard on the air, of all three of my guests' recommendations for this summer at our website, onpointradio.org. Jamie Green with Google Play Books. So great to have you here today from New York, Jamie. Thank you so much for giving us some guidance on where to crack a book this summer.
Thank you, Tom.
Kristen Evans at the Booksmith in San Francisco. Good luck, and thank you, Kristen, for joining us.
Thank you.
And Tony Norman at the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette. Always great to have you, Tony. Thanks for joining us today.
My pleasure, Tom. Thanks.
If you're looking for some political reading, we've got Jack Beattie with the On Point newsletter. You can sign up for it at onpointradio.org, looking at conventions past. Check it out. Thanks for joining us. Happy reading. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.